So this evening, let me warmly welcome Laurent Fouchard from the from Sciences Po in Bordeaux. Laurent is will be talking about South African townships and reordering South African townships, but his work also extends to for many years. He's worked on Nigeria and post-colonial social and political history in Nigeria. We're very grateful for Laurent to come here and present some of his work today, partly also because the Centre, in a few years' time, will be hosting a conference at the end of another project that Laurent is involved in leading, which is looking at the politics of xenophobic violence. It's a comparative project looking at a few countries in Africa, of which definitely South Africa and Nigeria are included. And Adam Higazi, who's a recent arrival in Cambridge as a research fellow at King's College, will be involved in this project and will be involved in organising the conference at the end of this three-year project, which is in 2013, we hope, and we'll be happily hosting that if we're all here and in good health. So, we very much look forward to that, and there's an opportunity to increase our interaction with Laurent and his team of researchers. So let me hand over to Laurent and say thank you very much again for coming to Cambridge, not from very far away, but from Oxford, where you're spending some time at Nuffield College at the moment. We'll probably go for about 30 to 40 minutes and then open up for questions and answers. So I'll hand over to Laurent. Please join me in welcoming.
Thank you, Charles, for this introduction. I would really like to thank both Charles and Adam for inviting me here and giving me the opportunity to present some of my work that I did last year and 2 years ago in South Africa. Maybe I will first present the paper, and then after the question and answer, maybe I can briefly introduce the collective project we are involved in on the politics of xenophobic exclusion in Africa. So let's start with the paper, and probably also with this first picture. We are here on Friday evening in August, 3 months ago, in Malenberg, a Kroot township in Cape Town. It's supposed to be a crime-ridden area. That's how this township is portrayed outside of the area. And that night, there is an ongoing patrol starting his duties. And with two middle-aged women wearing two different coats. On one is written Bambanani, which is an ANC community security program launched in 2002 by the Western government when the ANC was in power. And it was a quite popular program, the Bambanani program, because a stipend of 50 rands, meaning 5 euros, was given each day for members of the program. And most of the program was involved in securing the school premises. And on the other code, it's written School Safety Project, which is exactly the same program, except that it has been renamed by the new DA government that has been elected in April 2009 to get rid of the Bambanani program, because it was a too ANC-oriented program. The two ladies also wear the coats by night, so outside school time duties. That night they won't have any stipend to patrol the area. So they wear a coat to perform state functions outside the functions they were meant for by the state. So this story captures a part of the politics of ordering South African townships in post-apartheid South Africa. So this paper would like to understand various policing initiatives coming from both the grassroots and the states, and especially in order to interrogate collective and individual motivation of members for joining this organization. I'm also asking whether local actors contest, challenge, negotiate, or mimic the state. I also look at the role of political parties, came to play in the mobilization for security in poor areas of Cape Town. So my fieldwork is mainly based on 1 year and a half field work spent in Cape Town and in those colored townships of Cape Town, mainly Malenberg, which is a working class impoverished area, and Mitchell's Plain, which is part of mixed of middle and working class area. And so I interviewed a lot of members of those patrols, 150, and I participated to 7 patrols with this organization, which are referred locally as neighborhood watches, or street committees, or safety sectors. I also interviewed some members in the Department of Community Safety in the Western Cape government, and local ANC and NGO leaders. I will first have a brief look at the literature on vigilantism, community police, and the privatization of security in South Africa. So, just briefly and very sketchily, I'm going away from the failed state literature that have been prevalent in some American university, and quoting just a few scholars, we can mention that privatization of security does not mean the decline of state power in Africa. Instead, as mentioned by Beatrice Sibou, the state works by discharge, giving some functions to some organizations. That does not mean that it declines the state power. In this framework, vigilant organizations should not be seen only as the weakness of the state, but as their own cultural and historical logics. They are twilight institutions, as mentioned by Christian Lund. Twilight institutions means that they are twilight because this is the work between the state and the society, and what characterizes them is their movement in and out of a capacity to exercise a public authority. So these groups can be captured, recognized, absorbed, or institutionalized by the state. And so the state and non-state boundaries are permanently negotiated by local actors. So this is very sketchily, but I found it was necessary for me to just show you how far as am I from this kind of literature. And I really agree with the kind of approach made by Christian Lund on considering vigilantism, for instance, as twilight. In South Africa, there are 2 bodies of literature which does not really speak one to another. First one on vigilantism, and second one on community policy. And to report this, or to comment on this very briefly, we can consider that literature on vigilantism, done especially by anthropologists like Lars Burs or Stephen Jensen, have looked at the everyday forms of policing in different places of South Africa. They have looked especially at the formation of a moral community that was defined against some specific groups in the area they were working on, so against youth, against foreigners, against homosexuals, against prostitutes. So that was the kind of moral community that the vigilant organization tried to implement at the local level. And they also defend the idea of these groups promoting or manifesting a local sovereignty in which those groups were identified as the enemy, which is one of the definitions they gave from a local sovereignty. On the other hand, we have staff and research done on community policing, and the questions are quite different from the questions asked by scholars working on vigilantism. So some questions are on the where the community policing is coming from. Is it some American, Anglo-American buzzword that has been imported into South Africa in 1994. This is the thesis of Mike Brogdon, for instance, who consider that it's just a foreign institution that has just been exported to South Africa and that failed to be exported in South Africa. But others disagree with that. But most of the members who are working on community policing more or less look at community policing as something as non-sustainable if not supported in one way or the other by the state, financially or politically. So this is maybe too sketchy, but I think these are 2 separate bodies of literature. Actually, probably has the problem of I will say that we cannot consider one organization as being either vigilant or community policing, because if you look at historically at those organizations, some can come from vigilant organizations, transform into community policing, and those organizations referred as community policing can practice vigilant practices. So that's, for me, it's this, these differences between these two bodies of literature is a bit too stark and too obvious. More than that, there are three questions that have been left aside by this literature. First, we don't know much about the cycles of mobilization and demobilization within those organizations that are dealing with crime every day. Second question, we don't know much about the collective and individual motivation to join this organization. Why the members do join this organization? Why do they jump out? It's not really addressed in the literature. And then the last question is, what are the limits of the production of local sovereignty? And these are the three questions I will come back to in the paper. So let's first look at the role of partisan politics and party politics in the mobilization for security in post-apartheid South Africa, because it's an issue that has not been really addressed in the literature. And so I will just mention that community policing was a new post-apartheid tool for reconciliation between the community and the former racist apartheid police. There have been in the literature some clear examples of partisan political involvement in community policing, but in most of the literature it's not that obvious. And if I take the case of the Western Cape province, it's probably a privileged place of observation for these political battles around the controlling of policing resources in South Africa. Mainly because, more or less, if we have to briefly present, introduce the party politics in the Western province, we can say that on the one hand, we have a battle for the last 10 or 15 years, a battle between the two major political parties in South Africa, meaning on the one hand the ANC and on the other hand the Democratic Alliance, which is mainly a white and colored party. And these two parties are fighting for the control of voters within the majority of the population in the Western Cape, meaning the colored population. And it means that the place where I'm looking at policing initiatives are a place where those two political parties are fighting for the control of the two places. So there are various strategies that have been used by political parties to extend their reach at the local level, to support or to fight existing local structures like NGOs, associations, neighborhood watch, perceived to be aligned to the opposition party. So I have one concrete example in mind that we can discuss after the presentation of the seminar. But it's clear example of an NGO that has been sidelined by DA because the NGO was perceived as an ANC organization. And the NGO was performing a quite important policing role at the local level. But because it was perceived as ANC, it was really smashed by DA, stopping any funding to the NGO. So to use also political and historical registers is quite common by the two political parties in supporting policing initiatives. And I will have I will present a more detailed example after that, or also to implement new programs perceived as a political threat by the opposition. So let's have a look at one example to be more concrete. And I took the example in Mitchell's Plain, which where. There has been a long tradition of neighborhood watch since the early 1980s. Neighborhood watch are organizations that have been authorized in the mid-1980s. So during the UDF struggle and during the anti-apartheid struggle, there have been an organization or several organizations that have been authorized by the police to patrol their areas. To patrol the area, so which is the first indication of the difficulty to understand this organization working totally outside of police support. So we are in the middle of the struggles in the mid 1980s, and there are some organizations that have some police support to patrol the areas, while all over South Africa. We have some organization street committees that are fighting the state. But in that case, we have some organizations that are cooperating with the state and the police to patrol the area. So we have this long tradition of neighborhood watch today. There are 2,000 members participating to this neighborhood watch in Mitchell's Plain. And In 2007, a new director of the police of Michel's plane launched a new program, a new security community campaign called the Street Committee Campaign. And Jérémy Véret, the director of the police, is a former MK member, a former anti-apartheid fighter, a friend of Mandela in jail, and is a strong ANC leader. And obviously his wish is to probably reinitiate a kind of ANC approach to in dealing with security in that area. But actually, if we look at the details of the story of the Street Committee campaign, which has become one of the most successful stories in dealing against crime in that part of South Africa in the last couple of years, if we look at the practical ways that the initiative has been implemented, it was not initially a political initiative. It was to prevent the return of vigilant practices in the province. For those who are familiar with the story of vigilantism in South Africa, there have been one major vigilant organization in the Western Cape called the PAGAD, which was an organization that was operating in the second half of the 1990s, the way of operating was to more or less burn the drug dealer houses and kill the drug dealers. And it was smashed by the ANC and by the state in the late 1990s. Okay, so except that in June 2007, some groups started to do exactly the same thing that the PAGAD did in the 1990s and start to march against some drug dealer houses and burn the houses. And so what was the reaction of the police was to try to avoid that kind of vigilant practices. So what did the police allow the people to do was to start street committees, opposite to drug dealer houses to check people coming in and out of these houses. And so those street committees have been set in most of the Mitchell Plain areas. And so more or less there are members of the street that are gathered there and are checking people, youth especially, coming in and out of the drug dealer houses and trying to check in a way the drug dealing operations in Mitchell's Plain. And so I visit many of them, but maybe 20 of them just for one neighborhood, just to give you an idea that it was a very, very popular idea. The police claimed that there were 3,000 members after just a few months of operation, and so it was presented as a success story by the ANC and the local police and as a reenactment of popular mobilization. Okay, we mobilized during the past against apartheid, and we are still mobilizing against crime today. And this is the same kind of popular mobilization against different problems. And the example of the street committee in the Western Cape has been also promoted nationally by the two presidents, Mbeki and Zuma. And of course, it was soon contested by the local political leader, Helen Zille, who is the chair of the Democratic Alliance in the Western Cape. And she said, the street committee program is politically motivated and a strategy by the ANC to recover its lost supporters base for the party in Mitchell's Plain and to sideline neighborhood watches. So there is a clear political interpretation by the two parties of this initiative being highly politicized. And this is what the press reports about this initiative. But actually, if you look at what happened on the ground, it's not as politicized as the leaders pretend. And on the ground, the process of mobilization does not only answer the will of the leaders to mobilize people for a political agenda. People get mobilized for other reasons than to defend a political agenda. And this is why I'm moving to the second part, the economy of mobilization. Why do people get mobilized to fight crime in South Africa, and especially in that part? The first interviewing people and neighborhood watch members, street committee members, safety sectors, NGO safety sectors, all the members tell me always the same story. Okay, I have to volunteer for the area. I have to be volunteer for fighting crime in the neighborhood. And so this has been repeated 100 times by ordinary members and leaders. So there is a full economy of volunteer of volunteer work in South Africa, and which is not limited to the security sector. And it's hard to know where this is coming from. If it's coming from the 1980 struggle, or if it's something newer, it's a bit difficult for me to understand that. But it's a common discourse, and it's not easy to discard it as such. There is another discourse of, okay, I'm doing that kind of work because I'm a respected member of my community. And most of the members of these groups are elders. And and to show respectability is central for understanding the way people think of themselves and act accordingly. And there have been several works, especially in Mannenberg, so that's working class neighborhood in Cape Town. Several work which have shown that middle-aged women looked at by Hélène Salo, so in Mannenberg, show that women coming from this very poor and crime-ridden environment do invest a lot of their time in trying to give a good education to their children. And when they do that kind of work and patrol in the neighborhood, it's to defend their children. So, and it's try to raise children. So this is another explanation that is often given. And then there are some more practical issues. To get access to larger networks and to state resources. Obviously, being member of this organization, it's a way to socialize, to know better your neighbors. This has been said repeated by many members. I didn't know my neighbors before participating to this organization. To enter in a network with some kind of solidarities, for instance, there is a small funds and small budget for the organization to participate to funerals of the members. There is also a kind of a socialization, especially within the street committee. We've seen before with a photo with a lot of braai, as we call them there, a kind of barbecue that is organized, and people come here and share stories and have a time and a nice time in a place where it is supposed not to be safe to be outside by night. But with the street committee, it's easier to speak to each other and to have some kind of social gathering. But it's also being part of it's also a way to tap state resources, especially in working class area, because it's not only to have t-shirts, jackets, bicycles that are provided by the government, but it's also to be allowed to be in a position to be recruited as a volunteer and to get the stipend by the state. So if you are participating to this organization, you may be seen, or you are on the list, in some list. And when the government decided to give some stipends for some specific operation, for instance, on school duties or during Christmas holiday, they give stipends. And those members are really looking for this stipend. So there is an economic driven force behind this mobilization too. And one, I think, and the key issue is probably to look at the members' story life to understand why they get mobilized or not. And I'm building on that, so it's not really, it's not totally finished, and it's not a final finding. But I think we can distinguish professionals and amateurs, meaning professionals are those who are in those organizations for the last 20, some of them are 30 years coming in and out, but they are there. And you have the amateurs who are there, who just joined the organization for the first time. They are there for a few months, maybe 1 year, And they've joined the organization because it's a process, there is a process of mobilization at the neighborhood level. And if you look at their difference, the professionals have a strategy in a way. They have some interest, economic interest, to participate to this organization, while the amateurs are there on rather a voluntary basis and participate to those organizations for other reasons than economic reasons. Just a story of one of these professional members of this organization. So Fazlina Abel is the coordinator of Zone 2 in Malmberg. And she set a neighborhood watch in the zone in 1991. After her son passed away, she succeeded to build in the last 20 years a network of men and women to volunteer in a zone. She claims that she can have more than 40 people to patrol her area during the weekend. By the way, when I tried to patrol the area with this lady, it was impossible to actually do it, because she was always telling me that no, it's not possible this time, no, we have possible next time. And so I understood at the end that she was never doing that kind of patrol, because actually she was never getting any kind of money in doing that kind of patrol. But it's important for her to claim that she's doing it, because she knows also many members in the neighborhood. And actually, instead of patrolling the neighborhood, she has built herself as an entrepreneur of security in a suburb, and she can give her services to private party and to assure private security in and at social functions in some place in the neighborhood at a very cheap and it's a very cheap services. So this is just one story. There are many other elements to understand the economy of mobilization within those organizations, but this is part of the explanation. And if we look at, for instance, Workland, which is one middle-class neighborhood in Mitchell's Plain, we have here clearly some professionals and not some amateurs. And the professionals are, for instance, Michael Jacobs, for instance. He's a real professional. He's an ANC member, powerful ANC member. He's a CPF chair, at the Community Policy Forum chair in Mitchell's Plain, which is probably one of the most well-known people in the neighborhood watch in the area. And he's doing the job for several years. Cedric Daniel is the head of the neighborhood watch for Worklands in the last 18 years. He did the work. He claimed that he did the work for 18 years in the neighborhood watch. Justine Williams, she's doing neighborhood watch kind of work since the last 8 years. And she was part of the Banani program, so she was there for doing that. But now she's on a voluntary basis. She's another professional. But all the other members, most of the other members, are not professional in that sense. They are just newcomers. They've just joined the organization this year or a few months ago. They were former street committee members, and they decided to join the neighborhood watch because it was boring to stay in the streets. It was more challenging to be in the neighborhood watch and to patrol all the areas. And so we can have also this kind of distinction between the amateur and the professional here. Let's look now at the last part, and at the limits of the manifestation of local sovereignty. And I would like to look at the two issues that have been raised by anthropologists looking at the manifestation of local sovereignty, that vigilantism are the manifestation of local sovereignty in that part of South Africa. And I want to look at the two key issues, at the production of a moral community and at the issue of violence and human rights. First, the production of moral communities. Both in Malmberg and in Mitchell's Plains, there are some commonalities among all these organizations. There are mainly, all the members are elders, or more importantly, they are parents or grandparents. They all have children. And they came to patrol the neighborhood to defend their children. So there are no youth in those organizations. Okay, this is the first point. The second point, there is no discourse against the youth among those members. Nobody told me we are checking youth. We think that the youth are the targets we have to look and to check and to control. Nobody told me that. It's only in practicing with the people that I understood that the youth were the target. And they are practically the target because only the youth are searched by members of this organization. Parents can come out by night in the street, they are never searched. But the youth are searched systematically. And they are searched for two reasons, for looking to look if they have some arms, cutlass, and so on, and to look if they have the local drugs called tics. So this is the two reasons why they are searched. And so it's the issue of being violent and the issue of being drug addict is in the mind of these people a youth issue, which is quite strange, because not strange but strange for me as an outsider, because those two issues are also as a shared history. I mean, it's the drug dealers are not youth, the big drug dealers are not youth, but those who are targeted are the youth. What is also interesting is, and this is where the limits of the moral community is coming to, it's that this kind of power that is given to the neighborhood watch and the street committee to search the youth is both accepted and mocked by the youth. It's accepted because they don't have really the choice. If they meet a patrol coming to what term, they prefer to be searched instead of being sent to the police station where they will stay for the night. So it's accepted. But it's also really mocked and challenged because the watch have no power to enter private property. And so if many youth who are, for instance, partying on Friday and Saturday, because all these patrols are taking place on Friday and Saturday, all the youth who are on private gardens along the streets see the patrol passing and just mock the members, saying bam bam banane, so you don't want to come and check us. So they just, and so they are not really fair, they are not really frightened by this organization. Others just inform the other youth if they are really carrying some drugs and stuff. They inform others. They inform them. They shout. They not shout. They sif in French. I don't know the word in English. To inform them that a patrol is coming and it's easy for them to escape. In other places, as they are elders, they just run away and nobody can and no elders can really run after them. So the kind of the moral community and local sovereignty that can be implemented is limited to this reaction and the agency of the youth and their capacity to challenge them. The other issue is about violence, how far violence is used by this organization. And this is very difficult to assess, because in the past, it was very common, before the end of apartheid, it was very common that all these organizations were quite violent on a daily basis. Since 1994, there have been some complaints in the local community newspapers reporting the violence perpetrated by neighborhood watches. And there is a strong also argument made by Stephen Jensen, Lars Buss, and other anthropologists saying that those organizations, many vigilant organizations, are also reenacted violence on a quite common daily basis. And this is part of the definition of what is part of the definition of sovereignty, the capacity of reenact this violence on a daily basis or weekly basis. So my question was, do these organizations are really violent? And so for the 7 patrols I did, there were no violence at all. There were violence in 1 patrol. Most of the time, the members are very, very clean. they do search the youth, but on a very easy. I think they search people much more nicely than the police did with the Arabic in Paris, for instance. They discuss a lot of the rights they can do of the right they have to do that kind of thing. Generally, the members said, okay, usually we don't have the power to search those youths without the presence of a real policeman. But we do it nevertheless, even if it's not constitutionally right. So they speak about the constitutions. They speak about the necessity to preserve the constitution, and it's quite an interesting discourse they have. In one case, there has been a very violent confrontation. So in most of the case, youths have nothing to reproach themselves, and so they are left. If one member is caught doing a wrong thing, and that night it was a 17-year-old boy that was trying to rape a girl, a member of the family. The neighborhood watch came. The police was with the neighborhood watch. The CPF chair was there. They caught the young guy, and they put it in the police van, put him in the police van, and they beat him. Everybody. They didn't discuss about the rights of doing it. It was natural. I mean, nobody contested, but instead everybody was participating, and so everybody came to beat the guy within the police van, including the police. So it's in that specific example, it's quite difficult to understand what is vigilantism, because vigilantism is supposed to be. Oh, to finish the story, sorry. After that, this is very important. The guy is just sent to the police station. This is very important. He's sent to the police station, because all the members knew that the girl were not going to lay a charge against a member of the family. Everybody knows that he will be released very soon. So the story tells about the fact that it's very difficult to qualify this as vigilant or not vigilant. It's probably vigilant, but it's in the framework. It was authorized by the police. It was done by everybody. It was a common practice. But it was also something very short. It for him it was probably not that short, but. I mean, after that, the people started again their business as usual. It was so normal. So, and this is where I have some difficulty to understand how this works. On the one hand, we have on a daily basis something that is very that defends the human rights, that speaks the human rights, that is so common after 1994 in South Africa. And on the other hand, there is something that suspends the law for a small time, and that allow everybody to act violently. So, and I will finish with that last slide about where this is coming from, actually, and it's quite difficult, actually, because. If we look, this is a very sketchy list of all the organizations that were operating the same kind of control on the community in the last 50 years in South Africa. And you have different generation of organizations that were operating in black and colored townships. So I won't go into all this list, and this is incomplete anyway. But there are three points, two common points with the apartheid organization and one which is very different according to me. The first common point is the fact that during and after apartheid, and except during the period of the struggle, the 1980s, the elders in the township identified the youth as a social problem in South African history. And so it's the same today. The youth are are identified as the specific problem. Okay, this is maybe not a fundamental information, but if I compare this to the work I did in Ibadan and in the vigilant organization in Ibadan, the control is not so much about the youth, but it's about the foreigners of the neighborhood, and there is not so much obsession with controlling the youth in that part of Nigeria. In South Africa, it seems to be something that is so common and that is so shared and so accepted by most of the elders that is seems to be incredible. It's so accepted that it's not even said today that we are controlling the youth. It's only practiced, but it's not said. So this is the first common point between apartheid organization and today organization. The second common point is the daily practice of this organization. And this is also quite different from the other parts of Africa. The common practice is to patrol on Friday and Saturday because it's an industrialized and urbanized country where salaries were given on Friday evening and where salary was supposed to be spent on Friday and Saturday evening. And so people, both people who could spend their salary and robbers and gangsters could just rob the salaries on Friday and Saturday evening. So there is this shared assumption that township is dangerous on Friday and Saturday evening, and this is why they are operating on Friday and Saturday evening and all, not all the other day of the week, which can be strange if you look at all the places in other parts of Africa where patrol only on Friday and Saturday evening. So the difference maybe between the apartheid type of organization and the organization today is probably the fact that it's the relationship to the violence and the violence within those organization. During apartheid and pre-apartheid time, it was authorized to correct the youth directly on ground. In 1976, even a commission even granted the legal authorization to two main vigilant organizations in South Africa, the Makotla in Soweto and the Peacemakers in Cape Town, to punish directly the youth or any members, but that the youth was occurring. So it was institutionalized. The use of violence and the corporal punishment of youth were institutionalized by the state. Since 1994, it's just the opposite. What is institutionalized by the state is not to use any violence. It's still used in some case, but according to me, there is a tremendous difference between what happened today and what happened in the past concerning this, concerning the use of corporal punishment by those organizations. This is a major difference for me. And I know that it is quite contested, but by members, by scholars, work on this issue. But this is the point I would like to make for as a final point. Thank you. I spoke. You should have stopped me. I spoke way too long. Yeah, I didn't refer to to what was happening in the 1980s in Mitchell's Plain, but Mitchell's Plain was a central place, was one of the central places in urban South Africa in the 1980s, which get mobilized against apartheid.
The UDF was very
and the UDF was very powerful in that part of South Africa, and many colored educated members many civic associations, women associations, youth associations, unions were quite powerful in Mitchell's Plain and really fought against apartheid. At the same time, there have been no kind, well, I didn't discover it, maybe they existed, but I didn't discover it when I interviewed people, and I didn't find it in the literature, but there were no the equivalent of the area and street committees in Mitchell's Plain. While an area and street committee were really on the control of one specific area and one specific street, and to control both political and crime issues in those areas. It was very common in Guguletu, for instance. It has been studied by Jeremy Stickings, and it was prevalent, so especially in Guguletu, which was a stronghold of ANC in the 1980s. And it was still prevalent in that black township. So Guguletu is a black township in Cape Town. And it was still prevalent in the late 1990s and early in the 2000s. Now, I'm not too sure that I answered your question, but it's difficult to make sense of, first, the legacy of this UDF struggle in Mitchell's Plain today. Obviously, the ANC members in Mitchell's Plain or in Manenberg were members of UDF, and are some of the members are the ones who are really behind those organizations. And I didn't speak about one organization in Manenberg, but this NGO in Manenberg called Proudly Manenberg, set in 2005, was set by three former UDF members. And they are today ANC members. And they referred permanently to UDF struggle and UDF slogans. They have a charter, and they use all the UDF vocabulary registered to mobilize the people in this area today. But it's very used in a very instrumentalized way. And this is what the leaders say about. And they use a UDF register because it's easier to use register, UDF register than the ANC register in a place where everybody votes against ANC. So it's better to use the UDF register in that sense to get more people mobilized. But when I interviewed the foot members of the NGO and telling them, what does it mean for you, UDF? Ah, UDF, I don't know. Ask Mario, ask the leader. I don't know what does it mean, UDF. I've never heard about that word. They didn't even know what was the UDF. So it was not all the members, but the members coming from the working class with no education were really probably not mobilized really in that part of Mitchell's Plain in the 1980s. So there is still this legacy. It can be used, politically used, but the link is not direct, and it's re-engineered in a way by some political entrepreneurs.
Can you tell us something about the drug dealers' possible reaction to the interceptance of the daily business?
Yeah. During Pagat time, second half of the 1990s, so it was tough because there has been a real fight against Pagat members and the drug dealers, and many of them will get killed, but it helped in a way to multiply the number of gangs, and so it did not really solve the problem. So that was in the 1990s. If we look at what happened to the street committee program, I didn't mention that, I should have, but the street committee program, which was marketed as the more popular mobilization against crime in South Africa, or well, in the Western Cape at least, by the ANC, just ended up after two drug dealers killed two of the members in front of their house, because obviously it was a problem for the daily business. So they won, in a way. And they have. And when I visited again Mitchell's Plain, some of the neighborhoods in Mitchell's Plain, in August, a few months ago, I discovered that there were no more street committees, because the police decided that to have street committee, you should have a policeman in the street committee, which is just a way. Policemen do not patrol the area. So just imagine that they are going to stay with the mammies and with the old lady and old men in a street committee to drink tea. I'm not too sure. So there were no more street committee operating there. So it's what is fascinating. It means that okay, so they won. What is interesting is the police and the ANC behind the police, because obviously the guy is really an ANC strong militant, is they succeed to attract most of the street committee members into the neighborhood watches of Mitchell's Plain. So instead of, they have lost some of the members, but they were able to catch many of the members into the neighborhood watch organization, and so what is interesting for the state is to have all to keep this mobilization going on, and this is all the business of the ANC and the police in that specific area, to avoid the cycle of demobilization of members because they are not paid. This is what is difficult to understand. It's to keep the mobilization high for members who are not paid to do that, to do a boring job, to do a dangerous job, is not easy. And
can I ask you to be a bit more specific in assessing the consequences of the DA government in the Western Cape for this type of community policing? Because you suggested at various points that the DA, that this has become kind of a political football between the DA and the ANC. And I can see I can see why the DA would want to do that, but it seems to me that on the actual kind of the street level, if you like, that there are other vectors of identification which would probably transcend those types of party political issues, like, for example, the practical need to do something about crime, or even identity politics like the incumbent.
Yeah, no, they definitely, I didn't want to say that the DA don't do anything on the color country, quite the opposite. They just opposed organization that was supposed to be aligned to ANC, and that was they are really fighting for. So they have different programs. They support the neighborhood watch without any problem, even if they disagree with the director of the police in Mitchell's Plain, because he's ANC. They still support some. Interestingly, also they support some of the neighborhood organizations that are not, which is not aligned to the Neighborhood Watch Mitchell's Plain Association, which is perceived to be ANC aligned at the leadership level. So they are giving some money to some organization to support some programs, and the Safer School program, for instance, that have been an initiative by the ANC, has been totally supported by the ANC. They just changed the name. They didn't. They want to get rid of the Bambanani, but it's exactly the same program. The Safety School project is one of the more popular safety program. In the Western Province. It concerns 109 schools, primary and secondary schools, that have been identified as the most dangerous in the province. So they are continuing to do that. But what is more frightening, because for a political scientist it's quite normal business, but it's to look at how they sideline and how they marginalize this NGO in Manenberg. Manenberg is really a place where you find several hard criminal gangs. And clearly, Ellen Ziller just informed the leader that she will not support the organization because it's ANC organization. And clearly, I've seen that the difference. I did a patrol in Manenberg 1 year and a half ago, The NGO was mobilizing people. There were 20 members, among them 10 members of the NGO. The leaders of the patrol were the leader, some of the community leaders within the NGO, and it was quite quite impressive. I did the same patrol last month or 2 months ago, after DA stopped the funding of the NGO. Many members left the NGOs because there were no more money. And I tried to join the patrol two months ago. There were 4 members, no more members of the NGO. It was a process of incredible demobilization. Nobody wanted to get mobilized to patrol the area. And it was a clear effect of the party political divisions, which affect the micropolitics of the place. It's just tremendous. Concerning the hierarchy, this is the hierarchy I'm trying to conceptualize or to think about. It is probably seen as such in a way, because members know who are the, for instance, the CPF chair, who is the head of the neighborhood watch. This is really based on status rather than clear identification of being in the neighborhood for years or not. And for that, I'm not sure that there is a clear difference among members. It acts as it's strange because I had to really interview during the patrols for all night. It's quite long. It's all night long, so you have time to ask the questions and so why did you join, when, and so on. And it's only very late after interviewing all the members that I discovered that okay, so you are here for now 20 years. You're doing that kind of, or you came to do that kind of job for 20 years. But some of the members just were so new members. So you discovered that after. And I'm not too sure that the members ask the same question as myself, and so I'm not too sure that they're conscious about these differences between the professionals and the ones who are not. It's more, it's something that I've constructed myself. And the common discourse is we are patrolling to defend the children. It's always that kind of discourse that is defended. So now the first question is really interesting because I presented the organization as if actually the fight against crime was not a priority. The first discourse that is given is this, is okay, we are fighting drugs, we are fighting gangsters, we are fighting delinquency and so on and so forth. But after a while, you discover, if, especially with, I didn't do that with all members, but with a few members that I followed for 1 year and a half, and I discovered that, okay, they do that, not for that. They don't patrol to get rid of crime, but they patrol for other things. And for all the reasons that I gave to you. So I'm not too sure that I can go further, but for many members, they don't patrol for getting rid of the crime, but for many other reasons. And for making a living, especially in working class area. Even if it's not paid again. So this is what is complicated to understand, probably. Yeah, not too sure that I understand. I answer totally the question. Thanks.
I'll do a question that I had. I'm not sure it's fully formed, but it seems, going back to the original discussion around some kind of delegation or a positive choice around the delegation of this issue of security to a lower level and not seeing it as within a literature of some sort of failure or degradation of the state's authority, it seems there's some sort of tension between actively delegating, so thus still retaining that choice of authority, and actually needing that function to be performed at that level. So when there's a change in leadership or change in government, the need to positively delegate arises again, because otherwise you've ceded too much of authority. So it's not necessarily about the partisanship of the groups at the local level, but about the fact of being able to positively articulate the fact of delegation having assumed power. So I mean, that you could see the DA as needing to assert that the fact that this is still a decision that the state is making or the government is making, rather than something that just is a going concern that is not in their purview, but at the same time needing that function to be performed at the local level. So I guess on the one, the question that arises, which would be interesting to me, is if there is a certain amount of power at that local level, does it react back? Does it actually manage or strategize about how it deals with the state above it, and so this NGO or other groups, are they able to, they don't seem to have been actively thinking about the fact that they are a source of authority and they can use that again, is it the government of the day, or do you have any examples of that kind of thing?
Yeah. Yeah, this is also a very important question. In one way, it's fascinating how those organizations mimic the states on a daily basis and try to perform the functions of the state on a daily basis. And to that extent, I think they are not really challenging the state authority at the condition that the state authority has given them this authority to do, or this power to do that. So there is. And so, in that sense, it's difficult to make sense of a local sovereignty that will be expressed in a way here in that kind of daily practices, because they are performing so well the function of the state that it's difficult to understand how a specific local sovereignty can be developed from here. At the same time, they know that once the members should sign, all the members should sign lists and indicating before going on into patrol that okay, they are going to patrol tonight, and they sign at the police station. So it's really a power that is given at that time, and they are registered members. It means that. They have supposedly been trained by the police to search members in the community, and but at the same time, once policemen, we've seen a few pictures with policemen going around, but most of the time police don't go. They just are on their own, and they can do whatever they want. But I told you, among the seven patrols I did, there were little violence first, but second, and I did not mention that, they are implementing, and this may be an example for you, they are also controlling things that are not that are considered locally as bad. So they implement a kind of local or moral order, like closing the shebeens of the local unauthorized bars. They are harassing prostitutes. So they go, for instance, in one of the Mitchell's areas, they go on the beach, they know that the prostitutes are there with the patrons, they go and they harass, they mock them, and they ask them to go back home. They close any venues that are not supposed to be opened by night. So they implement a kind of curfew that is not supposed to be their functions, but they do it because they want to do it, and here maybe you can find part of their authority and part of their power. I will rather say the opposite. It's incredible historically and today how these patrols have been participating to the building of the states in South Africa, because there is a special disposition within the police service called the reserve. The reservists are members of the police, which are performing the police functions but without being paid. They have the uniform, they can climb the ranks within the reserve service. So they perform the state function without being paid. They are not civil servants. What is fascinating is how far. So this started in the 1960s. It was an answer to the state of emergency in 1961. It was a way to ask whites, male, to mobilize themselves while the police were checking terrorist activities. So, but then it was extended to all over to black and colored communities, and since that date, all the organizations, the peacemakers I was referring about, Neighborhood Watch, and then the Street Committee, are organizations whose members have been absorbed by the reserve police. And many interviews I did is, okay, we first get mobilized with the community, then we become reservists for many other reasons that I cannot give now, and they become part of the state, meaning that all this organization participate largely to the building of the state in South Africa, because in the last 30 years, or today, for instance, the reserve police is one-fifth of the police force, and there are members who really patrol, implement the order locally. So I will, instead of saying that those organizations challenge, yes, of course, they may challenge at very local level some state authority, I will rather say the opposite. They are really building the state in a way. Important, otherwise they won't do the job. They think they are reducing crime. The police think that they are reducing crime, which is something that is also interesting to look at, because they claim that they reduce crime based, but we can also say the opposite, especially for petty offenses. For instance, when they take some. When they succeed to have some drugs, when they catch some petty offenders, this is also immediately reported, or in the evening or the following day, to the police, and this enter the police statistics, meaning that statistics are really co-produced by the state and the community on a daily basis, and participate to the idea that, and maybe also participate to the increase of crime, because there are more police presence than anywhere else in Africa, probably. So this is only part of your, of I'm not too sure that I answer your question, but it is something that I wanted to mention. I'm not too sure that I was more interested by the fact that it's local authority when they patrol, but it's so conjectural. So it's patrol pass, and then things restart as usual. Business, drugs are resetting maybe 2 minutes after that, and it's so easy to avoid it that you think, okay, this is totally useless. But the thing that it is not, so it's difficult to answer.
Some more questions, I might draw this seminar to a close. So if you just all join me in thanking Bashar for his presentation.